Thanks for tuning in to What It Is on WNCW. I'm Joe Kendrick. Happy to be joined by Kim Rule and John Schacht. Today we're talking about the 20th anniversary reissue of Nevermind, and Nirvana also getting the tribute in the form of the Spin magazine tribute. Appropriate today that we have Kim on the panel because you spent many years in Seattle and have become even more familiar just by osmosis, if anything else, about all things Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, absolutely. We in the outside world still look at Kurt Cobain and Nirvana and especially that record Nevermind Smells Like Teen Spirit as such iconic things in recent music history. But in Seattle, it's very much it's just a different animal altogether. There's a lot of musicians who have wound up in Seattle in part because of the influence of Kurt Cobain on their early musical development. And I think that has a lot to do with the music that's coming out of Seattle now, that you have the Fleet Foxes and the Head and the Heart and Cave Singers and all these people that have migrated there because of Kurt Cobain's influence and that influence of Nirvana and the other grunge bands, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, is all still very, very vital and lively in Seattle now. Mike McCready from Pearl Jam is involved in a lot of local artists' work. So I think that Nevermind was quite obviously a very iconic record, and I remember it coming out and rocking my DeLand, Florida world when I was sophomore in high school and not knowing what to make of it and loving it. And
it was sort of the high point of all things alternative music because it was finally the big hit album that so many people had been waiting for, you know, in Seattle and really in the alternative world in general. You'd been kind of feeling the wave coming, and then it kind of crested with Nevermind, and where it really went after that, I don't know. It didn't quite take over like some people had thought or hoped, but
it did, though, change the music industry, you know, and that is in that early 90s period when they were making money hand over fist, you know, because of being able to recatalog or resell artist catalog on CD and people basically being forced to buy it, you know, who had already bought it once and they didn't have to pay for it a second time. So, I mean, the people that I know who worked at the big labels at that time, they talk about, you know, monthly plaques for Employee of the Month that cost $1,000 and trying to figure out kind of what to do with money. And a lot of that was based on that gold mine, really, of being able to resell all their catalogs. But when Nirvana came out, and Nevermind, you know, hit. I mean, I remember hearing somebody at Geffen say they expected to sell 50,000 copies and they would be excited about it because Sonic Youth's Goo had sold 100,000. And then it just went what we'd call viral today. And ended up selling, you know, 10 million records. And what happened, you know, with all that money that was sitting around in the labels, they began to use that to sign anybody that sounded like, you know, Nirvana, or that, because it was clear that they had touched some kind of nerve. And, of course, this is what record labels always do, especially the big ones. They try and repeat this formula because that's their bottom lines matter than more than music. And they did not. They didn't understand that the reason why this sold was because it had somebody writing some pretty good songs. You know, and I've always thought that that record was really just a pop album in kind of punk clothing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's because that's what separated him from the rest of that grunge movement, which was seen to be much more sort of metal, you know, had metal jeans in it, so to speak.
Yeah, I always thought it had more like 80s hairband jeans in it.
Yeah.
But it supplanted all of that. Yeah. That was the nail in that coffin for hair metal that was Nevermind.
Yeah.
Do you know what record he Nevermind booted off the top of the Billboard charts?
What?
Michael Jackson's Bad off the chart, number That's one good. Of the charts. I mean, it really did change the industry. It just came around at the right time. But, of course, you know, they missed that, the importance of the record and the sort of natural growth of something like that, and tried to duplicate it. And that's how we ended up with Bush.
And it also seems like it also seems like that what happened in the early 90s really gave rise to a real indie music movement. I think I don't know if it's just because I became conscious of it at the time or not, but I know Sub Pop sort of rose above the fray around then. Kill Rock Stars happened. It certainly wasn't the norm, but those labels have, you know, really laid the groundwork for what has become a norm of indie music, you know, artists really seeking out indie labels instead of major labels, and sort of that redistribution of power.
Yeah, because the major labels did not find somebody as good as that. And that's, and really, you know, they just sort of ended up with this real commercial alternative rock thing, mm-hmm. which wasn't an alternative to anything. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the indie labels stepped into that void and said, you know, well, if you like, you know, never mind, you know, don't listen to Bush or Creed. Come over here and listen to, you know, Yola Tango or, you know, Pavement or something that was clearly closer probably to the Nirvana or Nevermind aesthetic than those bands that I just keep mentioning. Bush and Creed.
And now Spin Magazine, of all places, has put out this tribute record, Newer Mind, with bands like Jeff the Brotherhood and folks like Meat Puppets covering Nevermind all the way through. And I don't think any of us in the room have listened to it yet, but I did hear one positive comment from somebody that listened to it, and I think it's a download that's pretty easy to access from Spin. So kind of interesting to see the sacrosanct, you know, grunge record getting the cover treatment.
And I think that it'll be interesting to me to listen to it, just because I think that there's not a lot of bands at work these days that are doing good that weren't in some way influenced by Nevermind. I think that could be the comp for my generation, could be the comparison to what Bob Dylan did for the generation before it. You know, like everybody was influenced by Bob Dylan in some way. Everybody's still influenced by Bob Dylan in some way.
Right.
But, you know, people that were in high school when I was in high school, it, you know, there's not anybody that it didn't touch in some way. Whether it sent them running the other way or whatever, it's influenced every single one of the artists at work today, I'd say.
Yeah, that DNA is still out there, I think, even with people. I mean, even at Sub Pop now, which, you know, which you point out is, you know, has a lot of people probably moved there because of that. But those bands sound nothing like, mm-hmm. you know, Fleet Foxes and Cave Singers and stuff. They sound nothing like that, but I'm sure that they probably grew up on it. You know, it affected them somehow. It's just, you know, the wheel turns in a different way. I mean, it's interesting that for years after that, or like the early aughts, Sub Pop was, you know, people, writers would always write, you know, once the grunge label, mm-hmm. you know, because they've, you know, those are the guys that put out Iron and Wine and the first band of Horses. And clearly something had changed, mm-hmm. you know, and it was really sort of the temperature of what people were listening to more than.
I think it was it the Shins that finally surpassed the sales or became the next biggest thing after Nirvana for Sub Pop?
Yeah, well, all they had to get past was Bleach.
Yeah.
Because that was, Nevermind was on Geffen.
I don't know if you're familiar with Carissa's Weird.
Yeah.
But I did a story on them right before I left Seattle that explored sort of the legend of Carissa's Weird, which of course was a band that its members, after Carissa's Weird broke up, its members went off and started their own bands. Band of Horses, of course, being the most popular one. Sarah Cahoon, who is the drummer, has her own solo stuff. She is working on a new record now. And then there's Jen Ghetto, the lead singer, who started a band called S. And there's another band called Grand Archives that's fantastic. But all these bands are very influential in the Seattle music scene, and were kind of, you know, that was a time post-grunge in Seattle where all of a sudden this lo-fi stuff was happening. It was kind of the era of Elliott Smith coming out of Portland and Carissa's Weird in Seattle, and people were looking for something to latch onto. And there's a lot of feelings in the Sub Pop community and the local music community that was sort of a turning point when consensus sort of turned to this more lo-fi roots influenced with a fiddle and a piano sound that eventually, you know, when Carissa's Weird broke up, Sub Pop started signing all those people, and that kind of changed the direction of the Sub Pop sound to what this rootsy thing that's happening now.
Although they still have bands like Comets on Fire and some good rock and some things that harken back. Today we're talking about the reissue of Nevermind from Nirvana, 20 years forward after the grunge scene exploded on the nation. Also, the tribute album that Spin Magazine has put out called Newer Mind. What are your thoughts? Email us what it is at wncw.org, and we'll highlight your comments on our Friday edition of the show. I'm Joe Kendrick, happy to be joined by Kim Roll and John Schacht. Until next time.